Nevada Court of Appeals. We have two matters on the 9 o'clock docket. The first is Rock Shadfar, am I close, against Evans. And the second matter on the 9 o'clock docket is Wimp against Brasher. Counsel here on Wimp against Brasher?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. All right. We have read the briefs in these cases. We have been into the record in the cases. We're familiar with the facts. So if that helps you streamline your presentation to the court, so be it. For those of you here with pagers or cell phones, I would ask that you turn those off so we're not bothered during the oral argument. And with that request, I believe counsel are familiar with the timing mechanism and the red and yellow lights and what those signify, and whether or not you wish to ask for rebuttal depends upon how much time you have left, of course, as appellants. With those advices, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Dudgeon. I represent the defendants and appellants, David Evans and Jill Evans. Your Honors, this case is basically about a loan transaction and an option agreement and a trial court order that granted specific performance of the option, and which would subject and does subject the Evans to a forfeiture of approximately $2 million of real estate. We're going to address trial court errors that included a finding of ambiguity in the option and in the court's interpretation of the contract. This was a true option that was not exercised, and therefore it terminated by its own terms. Specific performance was not available under any theory in this case, either if the contract was an option or if it was, on the other hand, as the trial court concluded, ambiguous, and therefore it would not be entitled to specific performance. And in addition, there were several inconsistencies in the order. We seek reversal of the trial court's judgment, dismissal of the complaint, and award of the Evans damages and attorney's fees under theories presented in the trial court.
Mr. Dudgeon, does it make any difference under your argument whether it's an option or a contract for sale?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think it does make a difference because the document itself and the interpretation of it was as an option. And, of course, in the case of a true option, specific performance is not available as a remedy.
Is specific performance available where a contract fails for lack of satisfying conditions?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that any failure to meet a condition, whether it's an option or a contract for sale, failure of performance of conditions is going to prevent any kind of enforcement of the contract. And especially in a situation like this where we had conditions precedent, and the chief one of those was release of the underlying mortgage to the USDA Farm Service Agency, also referred to as the FSA. We think actually, Your Honor, the basic issues were relatively simple and that the case actually is fairly narrow in its legal issues. It does not require any overruling or modification of precedent. It merely requires following the actual law. The case is important, obviously, because of the $2 million forfeiture that the Evans would suffer. And in the beginning, and I know the court has read the briefs and is aware of the facts, this matter started when the Evans wanted to borrow some money to be able to pay off the undisputed amount that was owed to the FSA on the FSA's underlying mortgage. Only later did the question of an option come up. And in fact, the original drafts of a note and deed of trust were in, I think it was January 10th of 2001. The first drafts of an option didn't occur until about 2.5 months later, toward the end of March. The note and deed of trust, it's important to be, I think, to be aware, they have never been satisfied, they have never been canceled. they remain today in the plaintiff's hands and remain facially effective. The option, of course, required that the FSA lien be released, and it was never released until June 16th, I believe, of 2006, which was about 2 months after the option had expired.
Mr. Dudgeon, if this is indeed an option, was the release of the security a condition precedent to the option?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. It was specifically required in the option itself. That, in fact, the terminology said that it's expressly understood and agreed by the parties that the exercise of this option is contingent upon grantor's ability to acquire a release of the security on the property.
And there was an expiration date for that release?
There was a specific expiration date of 5 years after the date of the option, and of course that passed on April 5th of 2006, and the option had never been exercised at that prior to that time.
Counsel, by its terms then, the option could not have been exercised, it could not have been a closing, until the security had been released. Is that correct?
That's what the contract says, Your Honor.
And the option. The security was not released for reasons that had nothing to do with, I guess, the conduct of either party.
In fact, the trial court specifically found that the Evans had made every effort that they could to get that released. And it was due to the recalcitrance of the FSA that they refused to do anything until finally the matter was resolved by mediation in the Tenth Circuit.
So what are we to make of the fact that, that the parties couldn't have closed as the option contemplated within the 5 years?
The result is, Your Honor, that the contract expires. The option contract expires by its own terms. And this was not something that the parties were not aware of. I mean, everyone was aware that there was an underlying obligation here that had to be dealt with before anything could happen with this option. I mean, it was virtually impossible to convey any property until such time as that release was obtained. And it was not obtained, despite the best efforts of the Evans to accomplish it.
Do you see textual evidence of an awareness that the closing could take longer than 5 years, that it could take longer than 5 years to release the security?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand that question.
Well, you indicated that the parties were aware that the security had to be released.
Correct.
But it seems to me, from the face of the document, the parties also contemplated that whenever that took place, it would be well before 5 years had expired. That the parties contemplated that the security would be released before the 5 years and the closing would take place thereafter.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the contract provides a specific expiration. And the parties were aware that there was this underlying problem with the underlying FSA mortgage, and they had to have been aware that it might not ever be released. In fact, in a trial, all parties acknowledged and testified that they were aware that this might never be released, and there was no guarantee that it would ever happen. And in fact, the Evans were aware prior to that time that the FSA had been I think the only word is uncooperative in their efforts to deal with them and to obtain release of the property and resolution of the entire case that they had going on.
Thank you.
That case had been going on since basically the first part of the year 2000.
Mr. Dudgeon, as I understand it, the buyers didn't want to take a second position, and the Evans didn't want to give a second position because of the due on sale clause.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but I think it might be a little misleading to think about that in terms of a second position. There was a question whether the Evans could convey clear title, and as long as that mortgage was in existence, there's no way they could have conveyed clear title, and I think everyone was aware of that also. In fact, that's why the term is in the option that requires release of the underlying mortgage, because otherwise there's no potential for a sale.
So, Mr. Dudgeon, if you agree that either, whether it's an option or a contract, that it had expired, what facts are you relying upon that would justify specific performance in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't quite understand that.
All right. What facts are you relying upon that would justify specific performance in this case if you are agreeing that, whether it be a contract or an option, that it had expired?
Well, we're saying, Your Honor, that specific performance would not have been appropriate under any theory in this case. On the one hand, if this was a true option, which we believe it was, and the terms of the option say that it is, Colorado law says that there is no specific performance of an option contract. If, on the other hand, the trial court had been correct in concluding that the option was ambiguous, Colorado law says that that will not justify, nor will it permit, specific performance. A contract has to be unambiguous, definite, and certain in its terms to be able to obtain specific performance. So under either theory, the court was in error in granting specific performance. Whether or not the court was correct in its order concerning ambiguity, which we believe it was absolutely incorrect on the face of the document. We think that the court was aware of the proper law. It cited the case of Hessel versus Neal in determining what the contract language indicated, and the court even acknowledged that that case had very similar language to the option in this case, and that specific performance was denied in that action. Nonetheless, the court then turned around and granted specific performance. It's a total logical inconsistency to have relied on the case but then gone entirely contrary to its findings. We think that in this case, of course, we believe the contract was clear. It wasn't ambiguous. The language of the contract specifically indicates an option. In fact, even before the addition of the typewritten terms in that contract, the language was language of an option and matches the contract that was declared to be an option in the Hessel versus Neal case. But then the additional terms were added, and those, of course, those terms control over the pre-printed terms. Those are even more specifically an option terminology. So that we think it is unambiguous that that was an option contract from the very beginning. The option, of course, is not subject to specific performance. The contract has to be clear, unambiguous, and completely performed in order to obtain specific performance, and that by definition did not occur here. So we think that under any theory, the court was incorrect, it erred in its decision, and that decision has to be reversed. We'd like to reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal.
You have close to 3 minutes, Mr. Dudgeon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Lynn French, and I represent the plaintiffs and the appellees. We've stipulated to call them the Nuries. That makes it much more simple to pronounce. I'd like to start out by disagreeing with Mr. Dudgeon's interpretation of Colorado law. He says that specific performance is never available in an option agreement. I would call the court's attention to the Court of Appeals case of Schrecht versus TNC Sanderson, decided in 2001 and reported in 37 Pacific 3rd 510, which basically pretty much parallels the facts in our case here. In that case, there was not as definite terms in the agreement, but in that case, the court did, in its discretion, award specific performance. Here we're dealing with a very unique piece of property, 192 acres, east of the town of Crawford, Colorado, where I live. And this is something that the parties had been dealing with for many, many years. They'd originally tried to do an agreement back in 1979 between the Clarks and the Evans. That failed because of the acceleration clause with the Federal Land Bank, now the FSA. And Later on, in the late 90s, they started talking again, came up with a purchase price of $150,000. Mr. Clark didn't have that money, but he did know Mr. Nuri, who'd been acquainted with the property also for 20 years, and who also felt it was a very unique, special piece of property, which in his words, I think the record shows, had the most spectacular view, or the greatest view, something like that, of Grand Mesa, Colorado, which is spectacular. I think the Judge Greenacre properly decided this case. He considered whether this was an agreement for purchase and sale and came to that conclusion. The printed form, I think, definitely is agreement for purchase and sale, and I think Judge Greenacre was correct. And Judge Greenacre found that the entire purchase price of $200,000 was paid in full, and that now the Evans were obligated to convey the property because the Clarks and the Nuries had fully complied with all of the terms of the agreement.
Mr. French, didn't the Schreck against TNC Sanderson Farms case involve a situation where there had been partial performance of the contract?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. This was a true option agreement. In the Schreck case, if I recall correct, Your Honor, and I obviously would defer to your reading of the case, this was a lease where the Schrecks did some farming on this property and had the right to purchase the property if they elected to do so within the terms of the agreement, which expired, as I recall, on November 1st, 1997, and then that really wasn't, I don't think, any kind of a performance, as I recall, Your Honor. But Judge Greenacre went on to decide that not only had the Clarks and the Nuries fully complied with all of their obligations, but he also considered this as an option agreement. And basically, his conclusion was it really didn't matter which it was, because if it was an option, by paying the $200,000 immediately, they had exercised the option. I think in the Schreck case, and I think the law is clear in Colorado, that you have to have an agreement that's in writing, which we have here. You have to have the names of the parties, which we have here. You have to have the terms and conditions, which I think are very clear. The purchase price was $500,010 payable, $10 on the signing, $200,000 on or before 5 years. That $200,000 was paid up front, so there was no question about it.
Let me ask you about that, counsel, because it doesn't actually say on or before 5 years. It says $200,000 at closing following release of security, but not later than 5 years. And so it seems to me that this contract unambiguously requires a conflation of several events. It has to be closing after release, but within before 5 years. This $200,000 was not paid at closing or after the release of security.
No, I think the contract, excuse me, I didn't mean if I was interrupting.
So I guess I want to focus on that, what I consider to be unambiguous language, and ask, how is it that the $200,000 paid even before this contract is executed can satisfy that clause?
Your Honor, I think that it satisfies it if you look at the last paragraph in there, that it says the $200,000 must be paid. If it's not paid or tendered on or before the closing date, then this contract is void. The reason that was paid on April 4th, 2001 is that, excuse me, let me get some water. This was a wire transfer, and this wire transfer was made by Mr. Nuri, who was not in Colorado, so that it would be there by April 5th. And I think we can all know, if we've ever dealt with this, and the court can take judicial notice, that the a wire transfer sometimes doesn't get there the day you want it to. The banks like the float, and he wanted to be sure that was there. So I don't think that's an ambiguous, at least I don't think it is.
But
I think
Mr. French, that it had to be paid. If you take the position that the purchase price of the option was tendered, wasn't it tendered in escrow? Didn't you have to have a closing? You couldn't perform until there was a clear title to be transferred. And both parties understood, did they not, that the money would be used to try to free up the title?
I think that they understood that the purchase price was $200,000, and they were friends, and that the Clarks and the Evans were close friends, and that Mr. Nouri wanted a half interest in the property, and he did what Mr. Clark asked him to do and wire transfer the money to the Evans.
I don't think it had to be in closing.
I'm
referring to the findings by the trial court. Didn't the trial court find, as a matter of fact, that the parties intended the money to be used to free up the title?
To attempt to free up the title,
yes.
That's correct. To pay $160,000 to the FSA for the undisputed portion of the amount that was due. I don't think it had to be into escrow, though. Normally, we would do that. I think it's smart to do that. That didn't happen here, but
What would happen if the title never got released?
Mr. Nouri testified to that at the hearing, and he said, I'm taking a risk. That's why Mr. Evans had suggested that he sign a promissory note and deed of trust to at least give Mr. Nouri a foothold in some sort of a position of record that he could deal with the FSA.
Well, what was the risk? He was entitled to a return of the $200,000 with interest. What's his risk?
His risk is that he wasn't going to get the property and the Evans wouldn't have any money. This was a specific piece of property that these people wanted to purchase. I think that basically the Schreck case sets forth, and I think this is the Colorado law, five different things you have to have. The agreement has to be in writing, as I said, the names, the terms and conditions, the legal description, which in the Schreck case had yet to be determined because it was subject to having to be a survey. And in this case, the legal description is included in the agreement. And five, the consideration. As I indicated before, the consideration, I think it's very clear, $10 on the signing of the agreement, and obviously an agreement is usually prepared before the day of the signing, and this was the case. $200,000 purchase price, which had to be paid on or before the closing, and I think it was paid immediately. If not, there were some other terms and conditions which would have gone into effect. But it was paid up front, so it doesn't really matter. Finally,
Mr. French, I just have one question. One of the terms of the contract is there is an expiration date of the agreement, and the expiration date would have been April 5th of 06. What effect, if any, does that have?
It would have a big effect if the $200,000 wasn't paid. If it wasn't paid, the $10 would have been forfeited, or if a portion of it had been paid, it would have been forfeited. That was the agreement. You pay on or before 5 years. And it would have had the effect that the agreement would have terminated. I think getting the release of the encumbrance from the FSA is a condition of the agreement. It's not something that the Clarks or the Nouris had any control over whatsoever.
So your position is that the agreement does not have an expiration date?
The agreement had, and was written, had an expiration date. But that date disappeared if the $200,000 was paid in full. If it was not paid, then the agreement terminated and any monies paid were forfeited. If, let's say, $100,000 had been forfeited, had been paid, that would have been forfeited if they didn't come up with the balance. But in this case, they came up with the entire balance. I feel that this is definitely not a loan situation. Judge Greenacre, I think, was absolutely correct in finding that this is not supported by the evidence that there was any kind of a loan. It was not supported by the conduct of the parties. I'd point out to the court several factors that confirm this was not a loan. One, Mr. Clark testified that Mr. Nouri never made a loan to the Evans. Two, Mr. Clark testified that Mr. Evans suggested the note and deed of trust as additional protection so that there would be something of record in the event that Evans were not able to secure a release of that encumbrance. Three, Judge Greenacre, in his findings, noted he gave more weight to the testimony of Mr. Clark and the Evans. Four, the Evans and the Nouris didn't even know each other. In fact, they didn't know each other till after this lawsuit was filed, and it stipulated that they did not negotiate a loan. That's in the findings, that's in our stipulated facts. Another very important factor that...
But wasn't the money tendered by Clark?
No, it was tendered by Mr. Nuri by wire transfer to Mr. Evans' checking account.
At Clark's request. I mean, Clark told, he told the seller that here, the money is going to be transferred, and that money's to be used to help free up the title to the property.
Clark did not tell him what to do with the money. He said, we're buying the property, and we're going to transfer the money to you. And Mr. Clark had no control over what Evans did to obtain that release. The another thing is that Mr. Nuri had to borrow $50,000 of that money. That's a very significant thing to claim that then somebody loaned him some money and he had to borrow the money. Mrs. Evans did not sign the note and deed of trust. That would be typical in a loan that you'd sign the loan documents. I've never been able to borrow money without having to sign the loan documents, and I doubt if anybody in this courtroom has, really. Mr. Nuri, of course, denied making a loan, and Mr. Evans, in his reply brief, says, well, he didn't document that. You can't document something you didn't know, but as soon as he found out that this was allegedly a loan, long after the loan would have been due, he had Mr. Kane on August 24th write a letter correcting the situation. On February, and probably the most telling piece of evidence that this was not a loan, on February 23rd, 2007, Mr. Evans came in Mr. Clark's office and said, everything's now done, it's time to make a conveyance. And finally, no payments were made under this alleged loan until September 10th, 2007. In fact, the Evans didn't even decide that the agreement had terminated until probably 16 months after this note would have been due if it was due. This note was purely just additional collateral to try to protect Mr. Nuri, who was taking a chance. He testified that, but he said he wanted this property. It was so unique. Mr. Clark had put a lot of time and money, had been in possession of the property since 1979.
Counsel, is there anything on the face of the note or the what was now being regarded as a purported loan that would indicate that it was conditional, that it would be repaid only if the purchase fell through somehow?
No, sir.
So on the face of it, it just looks like a loan, essentially.
It does. It looks like a loan. I have to agree with you.
Okay. Thank you.
If you're asking me would I've done it differently, yes.
I understand.
Finally, I think it's very important to note that the Evans have been in possession of the entire purchase price since April 4th, 2001, and that is really probably the essence of it. And Judge Greenacre did not abuse his discretion in ordering that equitable relief issue and that the Evans convey this property. So I ask you to affirm the matter. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to briefly address several points that came up in Mr. French's argument. In the first place, we cited in a supplemental document the case of KN Energy versus Great Western Sugar, which says the court will not consider the party's own extrinsic evidence of their intent when interpreting a contract. And we think that's precisely the situation here. The parties, the plaintiffs, are attempting by testimony only to create a different situation than the documents demonstrate. The documents demonstrate there was a loan and an option agreement. The plaintiff's testimony is the only thing that would tend to indicate that there was something different than that. And they are saying basically that the note is irrelevant, it's worthless, it's meaningless, there's only an option, and that the option was exercised. That's what they're actually claiming. The Schreck case was mentioned, and I think the court was correct in asking about whether there was partial performance. In fact, that Schreck case, which has a lot of good language that is pertinent to this case, was a different situation because it was an incomplete option as opposed to an ambiguous document. And the court held that the incomplete terms could be filled in by custom or usage or legal precedent. The fact is that in that case, the option was exercised, both orally and in writing. So it's a totally different fact situation, although the recitation of the principles of law apply here. The plaintiffs claim the purchase price was paid in full. We think that's simply contrary to the documents themselves. There's a promissory note and a deed of trust. Mr. Clark is the one who drafted these documents, the promissory note, the deed of trust, and the option. And Mr. Clark is the one who recorded the deed of trust. Now, if they thought that these documents were meaningless, they certainly didn't act like it. There is no indication that anybody considered that note and deed of trust to be anything other than a loan until the first indication, which was the original Kane letter of August 21st, which basically said, yes, it was an option, it had to be extended, and that it recited the fact that there was also a loan. That was the first indication from the plaintiffs of what their position was, which is almost precisely what the Evans position has been all along. Then 3 days later, they changed it entirely. They changed the story 180 degrees.
Thank you, Mr. Dudgeon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you, Mr. French. The matter is being submitted.